When you look back at, just the grand sweep of human history, it's incredibly tempting to view ourselves as this fundamentally civilized species.
Right.
Like, we think we're these peaceful creatures that just occasionally stumble into a war. We build hospitals. We write poetry. We construct these magnificent cooperative societies.
We do, yeah. We like to think highly of ourselves.
Yeah, exactly. But I was reading this historian, Will Durant, in his work, The Lessons of History, and he points out this terrifying reality that just completely flips that comforting narrative on its head.
Oh, absolutely. He doesn't hold back.
He really doesn't. He observes the human history is essentially this constant, unbroken chain of conflict. Like, war isn't the exception to the human condition. Historically speaking, it is the absolute rule.
Yeah, it's a really sobering foundation to start from.
It is. Because we are a species that seems, I don't know, almost addicted to conflict, even though we know the horrific toll it takes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we consume all this visceral media about conflict. We see the staggering statistics of global casualties, and we're just constantly reminded of the devastating generational cost of broken peace.
Right.
And, no one looks at a war zone and thinks, oh, I desire that reality for myself.
No, nobody wants that.
Yet the machinery of conflict just keeps turning. It never really stops.
And that contradiction right there is the central mystery we are tackling today. Because we desperately crave peace on a global scale, but even more intimately in our own neighborhoods and our own dining rooms, we continually fail to achieve it.
We fail at it constantly.
So to figure out the mechanics behind this failure, we are taking a really detailed look at a profoundly insightful sermon today. It focuses on the Gospel of Matthew, specifically chapter 5, verse 9.
Blessed are the peacemakers.
Yes, exactly. So our mission for this in-depth exploration is to decode the mechanics of peace. We want to understand why true peace remains so elusive, and more importantly, how we can actively construct it, like from the inside out.
Which is the only way it actually works.
Right. So welcome, beloved family members, to our conversation today. We're so glad you're here with us. And to start dismantling this, we first need to define what peace actually is by looking at what it is not.
That's a great place to start.
Yeah. And the sermon provides this striking historical baseline by bringing up the concept of the Pax Romana.
Ah, yes. The Roman peace. It is honestly the perfect historical foil for the kind of peace this sermon is advocating for.
Because we usually think of it as a good thing, right? Yeah. Like a golden age.
Exactly. In our modern imagination, we think of the Roman golden age as this time of, beautiful architecture, stable trade routes, and widespread civic harmony.
People in togas just debating philosophy in the square.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But the sermon forces us to look at the actual mechanism of that peace. Like, how was it maintained? It wasn't born from mutual respect or shared values or some flourishing of human empathy.
Definitely not.
It was maintained exclusively through the threat of overwhelming, brutal military force.
Wow.
It was peace at the point of a sword.
So it wasn't a flourishing society at all. It was basically the ultimate hostage situation.
That is exactly what it was.
I mean, the citizens weren't peaceful because they loved their neighbors. They were peaceful because they were absolutely terrified of the Roman legions stationed just down the street.
Yes.
That isn't harmony. That's just the silence of the conquered.
The silence of the conquered. That's a great way to put it. And the psychological consequence of that kind of structure is just pure anxiety.
I bet. You're just walking on eggshells constantly.
Completely. Because a peace built on suppression is incredibly fragile. The underlying hostility hasn't been resolved at all. It's just been temporarily contained.
Right. It's a pressure cooker.
Yes. And the moment the Imperial Guard looks away or, the moment the military budget shrinks, the rebellion instantly ignites.
Because the anger is always there.
Exactly. And the sermon uses this historical reality to establish a core premise about the human condition, mm-hmm. which is that you cannot enforce true peace from the outside in.
That just doesn't work.
It doesn't. Mm-hmm. And during the first century, people were desperately waiting for a political savior, someone with like a bigger sword than Caesar who could conquer Rome and force a better, more righteous peace.
Just replace one dictator with a better one.
Right. But the sermon argues that external control is a total mirage. It emphasizes that a person could possess unimaginable wealth, absolute political power, complete control over their environment. But if they lack true inner peace, their life is just a hollow shell.
Wow. So all that external stuff means nothing.
Nothing. You can conquer the entire known world, but if your soul is at war, you have absolutely nothing of value.
Man, that is heavy. Because if external force, like the Pax Romana, inevitably fails to create lasting peace, then we have to look inward.
We have to. There's nowhere else to look.
We have to examine the root cause. If we can't blame Caesar and we can't blame our external circumstances for our lack of peace, what is the actual mechanism causing all of our personal and relational conflicts?
Well, the sermon provides a diagnosis here that is just entirely uncompromising.
Okay, brace yourselves, beloved family members. What's the diagnosis?
It states that the fundamental root of all human conflict is sin.
Okay, sin. Which is a loaded word for a lot of people.
It is. But to understand this functionally, the sermon specifically defines sin in this context, not merely as, you know, breaking a list of rules.
Right.
It defines it as a condition of profound self-centeredness. And it describes it using this incredibly powerful visual. It says, it's the state of being bent entirely inward.
Bent inward. Okay, let's visualize the physics of that for a second.
Yeah, let's do it.
If my spine is literally curved so severely that my eyes are permanently fixed on my own chest or like my own shoes,
yeah,
my horizon completely vanishes.
You can't see anything else.
I literally cannot see the faces, the expressions, or the pain of the people standing right next to me.
Mm-hmm.
And if I try to navigate a crowded room in that posture, I'm going to be constantly bumping into people, stepping on their toes, knocking over their lives.
You'd be a menace in a crowded room.
I really would.
Yeah.
And the crazy part is, because I can only see myself, my immediate reaction wouldn't be to apologize. My reaction would be to complain that everyone keeps getting in my way.
Yes. That is the exact psychological dynamic the sermon is isolating.
Wow. That makes so much sense.
When human beings operate from a posture of being bent inward by selfishness, we lose the capacity for genuine empathy. Every single interaction, whether it's a tense negotiation at work or just a casual conversation in the kitchen, is evaluated through this single exhausting filter.
How does this affect me?
Exactly. What about my rights, my vindication, my emotional comfort? The sermon argues that this extreme suffocating self-focus is the fertile soil where all relational discord takes root and grows.
I mean, I see that in myself, but I want to push back on the application of this for a second, if that's okay.
Please do.
Because if being bent inward and colliding with people is the root of the problem, conventional wisdom suggests the solution is simply to stop moving.
Ah, just freeze.
Yeah, just flatten out and never cause a ripple. I think when a lot of us hear the word peacemaker, the cultural image that immediately springs to mind is someone who is highly passive.
The doormat.
Right. The person who avoids conflict at all costs,
mm-hmm.
who swallows their own grievances, who quickly sweeps the dirt under the rug just to keep the volume down in the house.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't the ultimate goal of peacemaking to just maintain a quiet environment?
It's so common to think that, but the sermon firmly rejects that cultural definition.
Really? It rejects it entirely.
Entirely. Sweeping dirt under a rug does not clean the house. It merely hides the filth and creates a tripping hazard for whoever walks by next.
Oh, that's a great image. A tripping hazard.
Right, because passive conflict avoidance is often just another form of being bent inward.
Wait, how is avoiding conflict being selfish?
Because you are preserving your own comfort. You're avoiding the personal anxiety of having a difficult conversation rather than doing the hard, messy work of actually healing the relationship.
Oh, wow. I never thought about it like that. I'm just protecting myself from an awkward moment.
Exactly. A true peacemaker, according to the text, is highly active. They do not flee from the discomfort of conflict. Instead, they courageously step directly into the mess of broken relationships, and they fight to create genuine harmony.
So they are running toward the fire, not away from it.
Yes, but they confront the issues armed with a spirit of reconciliation rather than a spirit of retribution.
But to walk into an active relational crossfire without adding to the violence, that requires an incredibly stable internal state.
It really does, which brings up a massive prerequisite highlighted in the material.
Okay.
The sermon states that you cannot be a peacemaker if your default operational mode is being a troublemaker.
So you can't fake it.
You simply cannot export what you do not possess. The sermon draws upon the ancient prophet Isaiah, specifically chapter 48, verse 22, which bluntly states that there is no peace for the wicked.
Meaning what exactly in this context?
Meaning if a person's internal landscape is defined by anxiety, harboring old resentments, bitterness, or unresolved anger, they are essentially walking war zones.
Walking war zones. You know, if you are listening as part of our family today, I want you to consider the physical reality of a walking war zone.
It's a very physical thing.
It is. Have you ever tried to rationally resolve a sensitive argument with a loved one while your heart rate is hammering at like 120 beats per minute?
Oh, it's impossible.
Your jaw is locked tight. Your brain is just flooding with adrenaline. The physiological and emotional state of your body is preparing for combat, not connection.
Exactly. You're in fight or flight.
Yeah. And you inevitably end up throwing verbal shrapnel across the room while simultaneously claiming, I just want to have a calm discussion.
We've all been there, and the internal state always dictates the external impact. When you enter a conversation in that hyper-defensive, combative state, you are no longer trying to achieve mutual understanding.
What are you trying to achieve?
You are attempting to enforce your own personal Pax Romana.
Oh, man. Bringing it full circle.
Right. You are marshaling all your intellectual and emotional resources to crush the other person's perspective so you can achieve a peace that exclusively validates you. You just leak your internal chaos onto everyone around you.
So this leaves us with a pretty significant functional problem.
A huge one.
Because if our natural gravitational pull is to bend inward into self-centeredness, and if enforcing peace through emotional or verbal dominance only creates anxiety, we are entirely unequipped to fix this on our own.
We really are.
We can't manufacture true peace through sheer willpower or like clever communication strategies. We need an external intervention. So where does the sermon say the actual power to be a peacemaker comes from?
Well, the sermon posits that true peace is not a human achievement. It is a divine gift.
A gift. Okay.
Yes. It directs us to the letters of the Apostle Paul, specifically Romans 5.0 and Colossians 3.15, which argue that Christ's cross is the definitive peacemaking event in the history of the cosmos.
The definitive event.
Yes. This sermon explains that this event actively breaks down the massive, seemingly impenetrable walls of hostility and sin that separate humanity from God, and consequently separate humans from one another.
Okay, we really need to unpack the mechanics of that theological concept.
Let's do it.
Because how does an event that occurred 2 millennia ago functionally alter my psychological urge to snap at my coworker or my spouse today? Like, what is the actual mechanism that translates that divine event into a change in my daily behavior?
That's the perfect question. The mechanism is the total replacement of your core security.
My core security?
Yes. When the wall of hostility between you and your creator is dismantled, the sermon argues that you are brought into a state of unconditional acceptance and deep, immovable love.
Okay, I'm following.
Think about it. If the ultimate authority of the universe validates your existence and secures your future, the psychological desperation to constantly defend your fragile ego evaporates.
Oh, wow. Because you don't have to prove your worth anymore.
Exactly. You no longer have to view every disagreement as an existential threat to your worth. The peace of Christ is meant to rule the heart, providing this internal fortress of security that strips away the need to tear others down just to elevate yourself.
So if the mechanism is ultimate security, then the action required on our part must be relinquishing our frantic ego defenses.
That's the hard part.
It is. It's like we are standing outside this arena of thriving, peaceful relationships, demanding to be let in for free. But there's a toll.
There's always a toll.
Right. The prize is a healed relationship, but the entry fee is something we instinctively despise. What does the sermon identify as this fee?
The sermon identifies this fee as profound humility.
Humility.
And humility is arguably the most challenging element of this entire framework. Drawing on Philippians 2.3 to 5, the sermon outlines what this humility looks like when applied practically.
Okay, practically, what does it look like? Because humility can be kind of a vague concept.
Well, it's not about thinking poorly of yourself, like beating yourself up.
Okay, that's good.
It is the active, intentional willingness to lower yourself. It's prioritizing the needs and the dignity of the other person above your own desire to establish dominance.
Okay, so let's look at the absolute hardest application of this.
Oh, boy.
The sermon suggests that the cost of peace is often the willingness to intentionally lose an argument.
Yes, it does.
That goes against every survival instinct encoded into our biology.
It really does. It feels like dying.
It does. We are conditioned by our culture, our media, our educational systems to climb, to dominate, to logically dismantle our opponents. I mean, we have entire social media ecosystems built entirely on the dopamine hit of proving someone else wrong in public.
We are utterly addicted to being right.
We are.
But the sermon introduces a radical countercultural calculus. It argues that it is infinitely better to lose a debate and win a person than to win an argument and destroy a relationship.
Win the argument, lose the relationship.
Exactly.
I imagine every single person joining us today, all our beloved family members, has a ghost in their past that haunts them with this exact dynamic.
Mm. Unquestionably. I know I do.
Me too. A severed friendship, an estranged sibling, a broken partnership where we successfully, factually proved that our perspective was correct.
We brought the receipts.
We brought the receipts. We won the debate. But we burned the bridge to ash in the process. We stood victorious, holding the trophy of our own correctness, completely alone in the ruins of the relationship.
And that is the tragedy of the personal Pax Romana.
You secured the victory, but the peace was utterly lost.
True biblical humility requires the emotional and spiritual fortitude to look at a heated situation and say, the preservation and health of my relationship with you is significantly more valuable than my temporary need to be proven right.
Wow.
That requires absorbing the deficit. It requires taking the emotional hit to your pride so that the relationship doesn't have to absorb the collateral damage.
But absorbing that deficit, it feels like self-erasure. Taking the hit, lowering ourselves, voluntarily letting the other person think they won, that is grueling, ego-bruising labor.
It is. It's exhausting.
What sustains a human being through that? If I am constantly swallowing my pride, what is the ultimate reward that makes the exhaustion of peacemaking worthwhile?
The reward is a fundamental and glorious shift in identity. The sermon points back to the incredible promise found in Matthew 5.9. It says peacemakers will be called the children of God.
The children of God. That phrase is, it's more than just a comforting poetic title, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's a declaration of lineage.
Lineage. Could you unpack that?
Yes, that's exactly the point the sermon is making. In the ancient context, to be called the child of someone meant that you bore their exact characteristics. It is the ultimate cosmic validation.
So you look like them.
Right. When you do the agonizing work of making peace, the creator looks at your character, your actions, and your humility and says, you look just like me.
Because God is the ultimate peacemaker.
Exactly. God is presented as the ultimate peacemaker, the one who absorbed the ultimate infinite deficit to reconcile humanity to himself. So when you lower yourself to save a relationship, you are mirroring the divine nature.
You are displaying the spiritual DNA of the family.
Yes. And the sermon expands on this by referencing Romans 12:18, arguing that within any community, whether it's a local church, a corporate office, a neighborhood compassionate character is vastly more important than sheer talent or intellect.
Which completely inverts our modern hierarchy of value.
Entirely.
We promote the loudest voice, the sharpest intellect, the most aggressive negotiator. We almost never design our systems to promote the gentlest person in the room.
We don't. Yet, history and sociology actually prove the sermon's point here.
Really? How so?
Think about it. A brilliant, highly capable troublemaker will eventually fracture and destroy any community they are a part of because their inward bending nature just consumes the people around them.
Oh, totally. We've all worked with that person.
Exactly. Conversely, a humble peacemaker, even if they lack extraordinary talent, acts as the connective tissue that binds a community together, making it resilient and strong.
Okay. If we accept this premise, and it's a beautiful premise, we run into a major practical roadblock.
Cool.
I can listen to this conversation today and feel incredibly inspired to be an agent of divine peace. But if I decide to deploy this radical, ego-crushing humility tomorrow morning at the office, in rush hour traffic, or while scrolling through my newsfeed, my willpower is going to completely snap by lunchtime.
Oh, 100%. You won't make it to noon.
Right. Practicing this level of self-control out in the wild is overwhelming. So where is the actual training ground? How do we build the muscle memory for this without failing immediately?
The sermon actually provides a highly specific, universally accessible laboratory for this work.
Oh, good. I need a laboratory. Where is it?
The primary training ground for true peacemaking is not out in the public square. It is the home.
The home.
Yeah.
Which also happens to be a stress test laboratory for structural engineering when it comes to human patients.
That's so true.
It's an absolute hardest place to maintain peace.
It is the hardest place precisely because it is the most intimate.
Yeah.
Out in the professional world or in public spaces, we are highly adept at wearing masks.
You fake it all day.
Right. We can manufacture a polite smile for a difficult client. We can suppress our annoyance at the grocery store clerk. We have the stamina to fake patience for an hour or two because the stakes of the immediate interaction are relatively low and, you know, we can just retreat afterward.
But the moment we walk through our own front door, the public mask comes off.
The mask comes off.
Our family members interact with us when our emotional reserves are entirely depleted. They see us when we are exhausted, stressed, and most susceptible to bending violently inward.
Mm-hmm. And they know our deepest insecurities. They know precisely which buttons to push to activate our internal war zone.
Which makes the family dynamic the ultimate crucible for character formation.
Yes. You cannot fake humility when you are arguing over whose turn it is to load the dishwasher at 10 o'clock at night.
No, you really can't. It gets real very fast.
The sermon emphasizes that if you want to develop the authentic, enduring muscles of forgiveness, patience, and yielding, you have to execute the repetitions where the resistance is the heaviest.
So the living room is the gym.
The home is where we must repeatedly, daily, practice the art of losing arguments intentionally and offering grace quickly.
Because if the peace holds when the family is tired, hungry, and emotionally stressed, then the foundation is truly solid.
Absolutely.
You don't magically become a peacemaker in the boardroom or on the global stage and then bring their skills home. You forge that identity in the relentless, unglamorous friction of your living room. And once it is forged there, you carry that transformed, bulletproof character out into the wider world.
It reframes every conflict. Every domestic frustration transforms from a mere nuisance into a critical repetition in the gym of peacemaking.
That's a huge paradigm shift.
It is. In the heat of a domestic argument, you are presented with a real-time choice. Am I bending inward right now to protect my own comfort? Am I attempting to establish a miniature Pax Romana by shouting down my spouse or my child?
No.
Or will I tap into the divine security I've been given, absorb the deficit, and prioritize the person standing in front of me?
Beloved family members, we have navigated an immense amount of philosophical and practical terrain today.
We really have covered a lot of ground.
We began by exposing the grand illusion of forced peace, recognizing that a Pax Romana, whether achieved by imperial legions or by just a raised voice in a kitchen, is merely a ticking time bomb of suppressed hostility.
A fragile, fragile peace.
Exactly. And we examined the uncomfortable reality of our own inward bending nature, acknowledging that our self-centeredness makes us walking war zones incapable of manufacturing true harmony.
But then from there, we explored the radical divine intervention required to actually change our posture. By finding our ultimate security in the peacemaking work of the cross, we are freed from the exhausting burden of defending our fragile egos.
Which is such a relief.
It is. We are empowered to pay the heavy countercultural cost of humility.
And finally, we brought this massive theological concept directly back to our own dinner tables. The realization that the messy, frustrating environment of the home is not a distraction from our spiritual growth, but the exact laboratory where we train to bear the family resemblance of the Creator.
The best place to start.
As we conclude our conversation today, I want to leave you with a new thought to carry with you, a logical extension of everything we have discussed. We have talked extensively about the individual cost of lowering oneself.
Right.
But imagine, for a moment, the macro-level implications of this framework. Think about a lingering conflict you are facing right now.
We all have one.
Ask yourself honestly, are you trying to enforce a Roman peace by proving you are right? Or are you willing to intentionally lose the argument today so that you can win back the relationship tomorrow?
It's a tough question.
It is. And what would happen if an entire community, a whole family, an entire workplace, or a local neighborhood collectively committed to this radical calculus? If everyone is actively racing to the bottom, competing to be the one who yields, competing to be the one who absorbs the deficit for the sake of the other, what is the result?
That's fascinating to think about.
Would that community collapse into a dysfunctional pile of passive doormats, easily manipulated and overrun? Or conversely, would a society entirely stripped of its defensive ego become the most indestructible, tightly woven community on earth?
I think we know the answer to that.
It forces us to ask, if true power is found in voluntary submission, does that demand an entirely new definition of what it actually means to be a leader in our modern world?
Absolutely.
Keep that question in mind the next time you feel the urge to win a debate at all costs. Thank you for joining us, beloved family members, and for exploring these difficult, beautiful truths alongside us today. Go out into the world and into your living rooms, not as troublemakers demanding submission, but as true, active children of God. Take care of yourselves and take care of each other.